Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Our disagreements are obvious. I mean, Cornell's honorary chairman of Democratic Socialists of America, and I'm not. I'm a traditional old school conservative. But I think that may obscure the profound points of commonality that really are deeper. Far from treating challenges or criticisms as personal attacks, he treats them as opportunities for learning. The only way we can hope to make any progress toward truth is to allow ourselves to be challenge, to consider the best arguments, the best that has been thought and said on competing sides of issues, and not say, I'm not going to go to Thanksgiving dinner because, you know, grandma's going to say something that offends me, or Uncle Joe's going to say something that offends me. We have to be open to the possibility of learning from each other.
Well, today, folks, I am joined by two leading public intellectuals, one progressive, one conservative, both dear friends. And I'm excited to have this conversation. Now, I'm just telling you, I'm warning you ahead of time. You know, you may want to bring a pen and pad. You may want to bring a dictionary because we go deep. And we have fun getting there with Dr. Robert George, who is a professor of jurisprudence and director of the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions at Princeton University. He has served as chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom and on the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and the U.S. President's Council on Ethics and Scientific Knowledge and Technology. He holds the degree from Harvard University and Oxford University, and is a recipient of the U.S. Presidential Citizens Medal and the President's Award for Distinguished Teaching at Princeton University. In other words, he's smart as hell. And then there's my buddy Cornell West, Dr. Cornell West, a professor of philosophy and Christian practice at Union Theological Seminary. He's also class of 1943 professor of African American Studies Emeritus at Princeton University. He is a graduate of Harvard College and obtained his MA and PhD in philosophy at Princeton. He is best known for his classics, Race Matters and Democracy Matters. Both Dr. George and Dr. West have a new book. It's entitled Truth Matters, a dialogue on fruitful disagreement in an age of division. It is out now. We get into it. Both very, very intellectually stimulating and challenging individuals as we dive into Truth Matters. Coming up next, right here on the Michael Steele Podcast.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Folks, welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. Well, we have a special treat today because at least one of these gentlemen and I have been in the fires together in an intense way. We were just kind of laughing before they came to conversation. Robert George and I have spent time in the past in sort of the Catholic circles, which is always so nice and so polite. and Cornel West and I have been in circles in which people start throwing things. So I told Robert, I said, well, get ready. there could be some things coming your way. But it's a real special treat to have both Robert George and Cornel West coming on the podcast to talk with us about certainly their new work together, Truth Matters, a dialogue on fruitful disagreement in an age of division, which we will get into. Cornel having come off of a presidential bid in 2024, certainly we'll have some important insights there. But welcome to you both. It's just a real treat for me to have you both. And Robert, to reconnect with you after, 15 plus years, man, almost 20 years. So
I think it's a little more than 20, Michael.
A little more than 20 years. Yeah, I was trying to be polite. You're just aging brother, right?
When we were together, you were a politician. Lieutenant Governor of Maryland.
Yes, indeed. All the good old days. The good old days. So gentlemen, let's start with the obvious and easiest, I guess, probably the hardest question in some respect. You both come from two very different political perspectives and backgrounds and experiences. How did you both kind of meet up on this particular project? And what was your first impression of each other?
Wonderful question. Go right ahead, Brother Robert.
Go ahead, Robert. You started off.
Well, I arrived in Princeton back in the Middle Ages, a brand new doctorate from Oxford University. This was my first job, my only job I've ever had, actually. This was in the fall of 1985, and I was hired to teach constitutional law and philosophy of law and moral and political philosophy, which I've been teaching now for 4 decades. Cornell arrived just a few years later, but by the time he got to Princeton, he was already more than a mere established scholar in the field. He was a leading scholar and a very well-known public intellectual even then. Now, our first interactions were at faculty seminars that were being hosted by what we call at Princeton our University Center for Human Values, and they concerned questions of moral and political philosophy, great range of questions. And there would be many discussions. We'd bring in distinguished visitors, Alasdair MacIntyre, Charles Taylor, John Rawls.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I would I'd sit there and make whatever contributions I had to make, and Cornell would weigh in from time to time. But those were large discussion groups, and many times the discussions would get rather technical. You get a lot of experts together, even in a field of moral and political philosophy. You'd be surprised how it can get. And pretty soon you lose sight of the big questions that brought you to the table. I mean, we're talking about moral and political philosophy. We're supposed to be discussing right and wrong, good and bad, justice and injustice, human dignity, human rights, human nature, the human good, human destiny, the big questions. But we would so often get sidetracked into these technical expert discussions, and they have their place, and that's important. But it was always Cornell. I noticed it was always Cornell who would bring the discussion back to the big questions, back to the matters that we were trying to understand more deeply. And even though I would often think he got the answers wrong,
right.
I would always say, you know, that cat is asking the right questions, and he's getting.
Hey, Robert, on that point, that was always my impression too. The first time I met Cornell, I'd always admired him from a distance, right, and felt his intellectual power through stuff I read that about him and that he said publicly and saw on television. But I always thought to myself, how can a man that smart be so wrong? I don't understand.
I had to say, he wasn't always wrong. Absolutely.
No, and that's what I, and that's exactly the point. He wasn't.
And I was learning from the brother. I was learning from the brother. So, you know, we knew each other, and we certainly had a cordial, I would even say a Cornell friendly relationship. But it wasn't until 2005 when one day a student of ours, he was a very fine student who had been in Cornell's courses and had been in my courses, came by my office during my office hours and said, Professor George, I'd like to talk with you about a new project that we have here, some of my fellow students and I, to create a new campus magazine called The Green Light. And the magazine would be our own magazine of arts and culture and literature and politics, a kind of local campus version of The New Yorker. And we'd like your help with that. And I said, well, anything I can do, I'd be very happy to do. I love it when our students get involved in these big projects, and they always produce great things. So he said, well, you can help in the following way. As a regular feature of each issue of the magazine, beginning with the inaugural issue, we'd like to have one professor interviewing another professor. And we have asked Professor Cornell West to be the first interviewer. And we asked him to suggest to us someone he would like to interview. And he said that he would like to interview you. So would you be willing to be interviewed by Professor West for this first issue of our magazine? Well, I was very, very flattered. Now, by then I, you know, was a full professor. Indeed, I had been installed in a celebrated endowed chair, but I was still flattered that the great West would choose me of all the very distinguished and interesting and accomplished members of the Princeton faculty. I mean, our faculty is filled with the greatest scholars in their fields. I was just flattered that the great Cornell West would identify me as his conversation partner. So I said, well, yes, of course, I would be absolutely honored to be interviewed by Brother Cornell. So on the appointed day, here came the student. His name was Andrew Perlmutter. And here was Cornell up to my office, and a photographer who must have snapped about 1,000 pictures over the course of the conversation. And we were supposed to talk for an hour. And you know, Andrew had an old cassette tape recorder.
Right.
After the first half hour or whatever it was, it flipped off, and he jumped up and waved his hands and said, don't talk, don't talk. And he flipped that tape over. Now he said, go. And we talked for, you know, the other half of the tape. And the conversation began about 2:00. And so, you know, by 3:00, we're out of tape and the conversation was supposed to be over. But I can tell you something, me and the brother were into it deep by then.
I love it.
We were talking about every issue. We were talking about the great thinkers of history. We were talking about the great ideas. We were talking about contemporary politics. Then we were going back and forth, and we were rocking and rolling and challenging each other. And we couldn't stop. You get the two of us in a room like that, even back then, we couldn't stop. So finally, I looked down at my watch, Michael, and I see it's 6:00.
No.
4 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
And Brother Cornell. I'm going to have to go home for dinner, but this has been a wonderful conversation.
Oh my gosh.
We really need to get to know each other better. Let's get together, have lunch, have dinner, something, and continue this conversation. He said, oh, Brother Robbie, I would love to do that. Let's do that. So I said, well, walk me down to the car. I'm parked in my car down at William Street near the Princeton University Press. And we'll continue the conversation as we walk. And so he walked me down to my car. And so I put my hand on the latch to open the door, but I stood there with my hand on that latch for another half hour, 45 minutes. We continued to go.
Wow.
Finally, I said, Brother Cornell, my wife's going to be calling the police with a missing person. Well, to conclude the story, and this is really how we got to be friends and teaching partners and more than teaching with all the work that we do together. And that was later that week, those of us who were more senior members of the faculty were contacted by the dean of the college, a woman named Nancy Malkiel. And she said, we need more senior professors, some of our best known professors to teach freshman seminars. We advertise ourselves at Princeton, making our professors available even for freshmen and even our most distinguished professors, but we don't have enough of you teaching our freshmen. Please volunteer. And so, boy, the light bulb went off over my head. And I said, well, Brother Cornell and I could do one of these freshman seminars. And you know, we could just continue that conversation. So I got in touch with Cornell and he said, Brother Robbie, that would be a wonderful thing. Let's do it. So we signed up together to teach a freshman seminar. We called it Great Books and Ideas, I think, the first time. And then the second time it became Adventures of Ideas, and we carried on. And initially what we did is Cornell, we have 12-week semester here at Princeton. You know, you pay a lot of money for not much education. But over the course of the 12 weeks, we decided we'd do one big great book a week. Classic text, ideally a text that has been important in our own intellectual and spiritual journeys. So Cornell chose six and I chose six. We began with Sophocles' Antigone. We read Plato's Gorgias, which has been a very important text in my life. St. Augustine's Confessions, and then all the way up to the 20th century with writers like John Dewey and C.S. Lewis, and it ended with Martin Luther King, the letter from Birmingham Jail.
Oh, yeah.
It was just a wonderful seminar. I mean, from the moment the seminar began, the first week when we were reading Antigone by Sophocles, it was more than chemistry. People talk about chemistry between two people teaching together. This was more than, it was magic.
Right.
It was magic.
Right.
And that conversation that began in my office has not stopped.
I bet it hasn't. I bet it hasn't.
And we continued teaching together until Brother Cornell abandoned me to go to Harvard.
And, he traded down. We can admit that he traded down.
I can understand that, why he would trade down like that, but he did it. But even then, he came back on his first leave of absence. He came back and we taught the course again at Princeton. But then, since we weren't able to teach together regularly, we basically took our show on the road. And we've been lecturing and talking together at universities and other institutions all over the country ever since. And I've just learned so much from these dialogues with Cornell, and I love him so much. And, you know, we've just really enjoyed, I certainly have, just building this friendship, and more than a friendship. We've become really literally family to each other. Cornell's daughter Zaytoun calls me quite unselfconsciously Uncle Robbie. You know, we're a couple of peas in a pod right now.
So Cornell, from your perspective, how did you it's always interesting when, you know, you have two friends coming together and the perspectives on how it all began is always, it's always fun. It's like my wife and I have very different versions of our meeting. You know, so we know how that goes. How did you see it? And in your impressions of Robbie, what, if I may, Doctor, I heard you refer to, I don't want to disrespect you because you are an eminent person in your field. So Dr. George, Robert, whatever you want me to call you, I'll be happy to call you. No,
everybody calls me Ron.
Cornell's my boy, so yeah. You know, but in addition to your impression that led to this collaboration, what do you think people have come to understand about your friendship with Dr. George?
Yeah, I appreciate the question, though, brother. And again, thank you so much for having us on, not just to talk about the book, but just to have a good time.
Yes.
Revel in each other's humanity. Because, no, the thing about Brother Robbie, I recognized immediately, even before I got a chance to spend time with him, was that, you see, in the culture of professionalism and the culture of the university, where there's such a stress on conformity and trying to adapt to whatever the mainstream or the orthodoxy or the dogmas are. I said, Brother Robbie's a brother. He says what he means. He means what he says. And he has a commitment to what the great Du Bois called integrity, honesty, decency, and courage, which are the four pillars of any serious vocation, be it intellectual, existential, or what have you. I know you distinguished graduate of John Hopkins, spending that time at Villanova, Augustinian Friars, and then J.D. from Georgetown. So that's just not professional, that's vocation, cuts much deeper, you see. And to be able to meet a brother who has a calling, not just a career.
Mm-hmm.
So when we got a chance to spend time and teach, because he's a masterful teacher, and see, he would teach the left wing text, I would teach the right wing text, just to let the students know that this is an intellectually explosive space where no one is safe. Everybody's respected.
Right.
But nobody's safe, because when Antigone gets done with, well, when Sophocles get done with you, if you're not on the edge of life of bitch, you better reread the text. We dealing with death and life and agony and anguish and insecurity and anxiety and nihilism and a whole host of things. That's what it is to be educated. And Brother Robbie has this profound commitment to truth seeking and serious, what the Greeks call paideia, which is deep education, not cheap schooling. And so, been after 20 years now, we travel all over the country and so forth. It's like much deeper than friendship. You know, he's my brother. He says he's a member of the family. His precious mother just passed, 92 years old. We're gonna have the funeral next weekend. So my prayers are with him. I wish I could be there physically, but he knows my prayers would be with him. Stay tuned as well and so forth. And I mean, you met my mother, Irene.
Absolutely. Right. Wonderful, beautiful woman.
And my other brother, Cliff. And your precious mother was my Belle, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, this is serious business. You're talking about humanity at its deepest level. Now, I think he's wrong on a whole lot of political ideological issues. And we can fight over that. But at that deeper human level, that's the crucial thing. And me and Brother Michael had already a human connection, not just at the concert, but in other contexts as well. This Republican brother coming out of Maryland with this Catholic sensibility and this wonderful smile and still wrong. What's going on here? We have a good time. Bobby and I have been able to do that for 20-some years in elections. Yeah. We've done it in chocolate places in Dallas and vanilla places and integrated, you know, multiracial spaces across the nation.
I love it. It really is. You know, what I've learned certainly in my years, in politics, but even before that, which is what I try to bring in, it seems to be what you two gentlemen have brought to the conversation, both from an intellectual as well as a practical matter. The humanity of the individual is what ultimately informs the behavior and the reaction and the understanding. You both note in the book, we can know things by inquiry and deliberation, by grasping the truth of the matter, by judging soundly. Aristotle taught that there are two categories of truth, practical and rhetorical, but there's only one intellect. And that's the piece that sort of operates and operationalizes the aspirations, the dreams, the hopes, the progress of an individual, a people, a nation. When you're looking at today's society, gentlemen, you see people who are cut off. But it's not just that intellectual disconnect where they just stop learning and making inquiry. It is also that sort of personal distancing. And we've joked coming out of the years of the first Trump administration and then COVID, and now, you know, wading through the Biden era into another Trump administration, you have this further disconnect of that human experience, which you both seem to embody. You joke about how you may disagree politically, but as you said, Cornell, is that deeper human element that allows that disagreement not to be so personal and so toxic that as we would joke about Thanksgiving during the Trump era, people just they stopped seeing grandma. I'm not going to grandma's house because she supports Trump and I can't deal with that. Or I'm not going to, you know, hang out with cousin Joe because he's a Biden guy, and I can't deal with that. What is it that we've lost when you think about that inquiry and deliberation that Aristotle referred to that has now disabled our ability to communicate with each other?
Well, shall I say a few words about that and then turn it over to Cornell?
Sure.
Our disagreements are obvious. I mean, Cornell's honorary chairman of Democratic Socialists of America, and I'm not honorary chairman of Democratic Socialists. I'm a traditional old school conservative. But I think that may obscure the profound points of commonality that really are deeper. Number one, I see in my brother Cornell a truth seeker. Someone who has not fallen so in love with his own opinions that he would rather persist in his opinions than have to give them up under the pressure of rational scrutiny and rational argument. Far from treating challenges or criticisms as personal attacks, which a lot of people do today.
Yeah.
He treats them as opportunities for learning. He wants to be challenged because he wants to get at the truth of things. He's wrong about something, he wants to know he's wrong. And I try to be the same way. I try to be a truth seeker, not so in love with my opinions, not wrapping my emotions so tightly around my convictions, right, to become a dogmatist or an ideologue. You know, people don't know the real Cornell West, let me tell you that, as I do. The Cornell West I know is the Cornell West who understands more deeply than any conservative scholar I know the conservative intellectual tradition.
I definitely would agree with that.
Who knows more about Edmund Burke, Leo Strauss, Eric Voegelin, than Cornell West? Where will you find Cornell West every year in September? At the Eric Voegelin meeting of the American Political Science Association with all those conservatives. Because he understands that even though he comes out in a different place, the great thinkers of the conservative tradition have something to say. And he wants to be challenged by that. And I feel the same way from the other direction. Number two, we're both Christians and we're both serious about our faith. We're frail and fallen and fallible, and we fall short and we fall down and we have to lift ourselves back up. Believe me, you got a couple of cracked vessels here. But we believe in the principle of Genesis 1, the Imago Dei, that every single human being, no matter how weak, vulnerable, frail, no matter how fallen, no matter how far astray they've gone, is made in the very image and likeness of God.
Mm-hmm.
We both share that. That's a starting point. Now, we'll defend it. It's not a starting point that we're going to defend arbitrarily. You know, they're going to hold our.
Right.
We'll defend it. But it's a starting point from everything else. So when we discuss the big issues, human nature, the human good, human dignity, human rights, human destiny, we're starting from a common ground. Now, how to apply that principle? Sometimes we come out different places. But we're starting from a common ground, and we know each other's hearts. And I know Cornell's heart is in the right place. He is not a dogmatist. He is not an ideologue. People don't understand that. He wants to get at the truth of things. He has never resisted a challenge for me, and I have never resisted a challenge for him. We can have a genuine conversation because we've got a common ground. We've got a common good. We both want to get truth to the matter, and we both recognize our own fallibility. We both recognize we're wrong about some stuff. Right now, we know we're wrong about some stuff. The only problem is we don't know what the things are we're wrong about.
Everyone is wrong
about some stuff. You got some false ideas in your head. I don't care who's listening out there. Every single one. You got some false ideas in your head. One sure way to make sure those false ideas stay in your head and aren't replaced by true ideas is never allow yourself to be challenged. Only listen to people who will confirm you in your beliefs. They'll confirm you in your beliefs that happen to be true, but they'll also confirm you in your beliefs that happen to be false. The only way we can hope to make any progress toward truth is to allow ourselves to be challenged, to consider the best arguments, the best that has been thought and said on competing sides of issues, and not say, I'm not going to go to Thanksgiving dinner because, you know, grandma's going to say something that offends me or Uncle Joe's going to say something that offends me. We have to be open to the possibility of learning from each other. Let's recognize our own fallibility and embrace the intellectual humility without which, A, we're not going to deepen our understanding. We're not going to get anywhere near true wisdom. And B, we're going to break our social bonds. They will break. They are fragile. And we deserve them.
Yeah, but Cornell, have we? I really appreciate what Robert is saying. And it, you know, to put it in one vernacular context, that's great on paper. But the reality of it is people want that confirmation bias. right? They want to be in a space in which the thing that they have now concluded in their own mind without any intellectual rigor, without even picking up a damn book to get a perspective on it, or not critically thinking about or questioning the source of the thought that they have in their head. Folks are comfortable there. How you know, this book is titled Truth Matters. So let's start with the question: what the hell is truth? If I think it's true that DEI caused the airline crash that happened last week, or if I think DEI is why my son didn't get a job, or my daughter was fired from a job, if I've created a truth around these things, how do you begin? Then what matters if my truth is off in the first instance?
No, it's not, I hear exactly what you're saying. You see, part of the challenge is that, you know, we're living in a moment of such spiritual decay and moral decrepitude. And what I mean by that is the virtues, faith, hope, and love, or justice and courage, the virtues have been so pushed to the margins, and the enabling virtue of all the other virtues is courage. And courage is in short supply. You can't even engage in a quest for truth without courage. I mean, we know that the Black National Anthem is lift every voice. Mm-hmm. You can't have a voice without courage. You can have an echo without courage, but you can't have a voice. Most of our culture is just echoes of silos because it's conformity. It's tied to career, it's tied to what you've been told. Nobody right. thinking for themselves independently, courageously. And then the larger step, and this is, you know, the difference between Jesus and Socrates, right? He never sheds a tear. Jesus weeps, which means Socrates never really loves anybody deeply. Jesus weeps because he loves persons concretely, but it takes courage to love, courage to tell the truth. But if what you have is just cowardly accommodation or adjustment to unjust status quo just for career, and this cuts across politics, cuts across ideology, it cuts across skin pigmentation, cuts across sexual orientation and religion. It's a human thing. And we're living at a moment in the history of this empire. It's been about 70 since the beginning of the species. United States is 68. Empires come and go. And when you have civic cowardliness or lack of civic courage, and then on a personal spiritual level, it's simply all about materialism, narcissism, individualism, egoism. Where is the compassion? Where's the courage to interrupt it? Then you end up with neo-fascist spirits, neo-fascist sensibilities, neo-fascist policies. And you don't begin with Trump. He's the sign and the symptom of it, but he is the concrete manifestation of it. And that's just gangsterism crystallized. And it's a human thing.
True. Yeah.
It's gangsterism crystallized, a human thing. Gangster inside of each and every one of us. We got to fight it every day on the battlefield of our own souls. But when the gangsterism wins and there's no space for humanity, serious engagement with issues that we know are bigger than us. So Brother Robbie and I begin with what? We know truth, capital T, is bigger than us. I don't have a monopoly on truth or beauty or goodness or the holy.
Mm-hmm.
No one does, but we could try to get at it. If we're humble enough, if we have enough intellectual humility, we can try to get at it. And in trying to get at it, we learn a whole lot from each other, and we might be able to sustain some democratic possibilities in a moment of such overwhelming spiritual decay and moral decrepitude.
You actually have a very interesting back and forth in the book on this question of truth right out of the gate. At one point, Robert, you make the point in that context. You ask, well, where does truth talk come in? It's within these various traditions that are trying to get us outside of ourselves and make claims about reality, because reality is bigger than our egos. It's bigger than our subjectivities. That's it's right. bigger than our families. It's bigger than our tribes. It's bigger yep. than our nations. I would argue that very much like virtues and the unity of virtues, be they pagan or Christian or Judaic or whatever that truth is, inseparable from beauty and goodness and even the holy. Truth talk without beauty talk is impoverishing to me. Truth in a way is like Kierkegaard on love, one in many. And then you hit, you nail the point by with the question. So truth then is a property of reality. And Cornell, you going, there are transcendental universals that get us outside of our egocentric predicaments, always in the context of our tradition, because we're temporary historical creatures. You guys go, it's fascinating when you're reading what you've written, you go in and out of these very deep intellectual spaces, and then you sort of come up out on a leveled landscape in which there's a higher degree of understanding and clarity, which is what you were laying out, Robert, in the paragraph I just read. And then Cornell just kind of go, yes. So let me take you into the underside so you can understand why what you just asked is relevant. I set the question up that way because it for me, in reading the text, the one questions that come back to me that you both are in this classroom space, and it begs, have you noticed the intellectual curiosity and sort of truth-seeking spirit change within your students?
Oh, when we teach the seminar?
Yeah.
Our job, it's our vocation, is to awaken that truth-seeking spirit. Everybody, every student I've ever taught in four decades has got it down there in them, but often it needs to be ignited, needs to be brought forward. Now, you know, you're having to deal with some real problems today because students are brought up in a culture of tribalism.
Right.
In those silos Cornell was talking about. You know, on one side, they watch Fox News and they read the Wall Street Journal editorial page, and they maybe, you know, read Compact Magazine or something. No, those are all fine. I have no objections to any of them. But people are getting one story and they're being reinforced in everything they already believe. On the other side, they watch MSNBC or CNN, you know, they read the New York Times editorial page, you know, they read the, you know, whatever the equivalent of National Review magazine. I don't know if the New Republic is still going or something like that, or the Nation or whatever it is. And they're reinforced. And what happens is the idea that there's a truth that transcends ideology and that's got to be honored so that we don't fall so deeply in love with our own convictions that we lose sight of truth and fall out of touch with reality. We've got a big problem there. So as teachers, what we've got to do is help students to overcome that spirit of tribalism. Now, we have to be honest with the students. You pay a price for that. You just do. And that's because some of the communities that we belong to and we value and we treasure our membership in are communities of conviction. Their political parties, their ideological categories, and so on. And to be a member in good standing of that community and to have those relationships with you value, honestly, means conforming. And when you're out of conformity, you're out of the group. And Cornell and I have both experienced that.
Oh, tell me about it, brother.
If you take the right, if you have to, Michael, if you know, we have to be honest with students.
Hey Robert,
everybody's going to love you. Everybody's not going to love you.
When I got to the RNC, I told people, and even in most of my political career, I've always told people, you know, I don't play well with others. So I'm just telling you, I'm not going to be your average little conservative Republican, because that's not how this works. But
well, when I refused to go along with Trump, you know, I was out. When Cornell refused to go along with Hillary Clinton, or when he criticized Barack Obama, he was out because you're not allowed to do that. You know, you're out of bounds. You're expected to conform. And that costs real relationships. We have to, again, be honest with our students. We can't say, oh, everyone's going to love you. Everything's going to be fine. You know, if you're an actual independent thinker, if you're a genuine truth seeker, your life's going to be hunky-dory. Well, it didn't work out that way for Socrates. And you take some real risks when you engage in the Socratic project. And nevertheless, it's our job to do it, to model it for our students, and to encourage them to abandon the groupthink, abandon the conformism, abandon the ideology, and start actually prioritizing and honoring truth above all else.
Cornell, is that the truth-seeking spirit? What is that? How do you guys define that in the book, the truth-seeking spirit?
Oh, I think we're engaging in a creative fusion of the Socratic legacy of Athens, where true seeking has to do with courageous self-examination and courageous examination of society and the world on the one hand, but also the prophetic legacy of Jerusalem. And this is very important because both Robbie and I, as Christians, we really do zero in on that Palestinian Jew named Jesus, with the legacies of Augustine and St. Francis of Assisi and Fannie Lou Hamer and Julian of Norwich, a very rich tradition in which truth is not an abstract proposition. It is a concrete fleshification of God. When Jesus says, I am the truth, that is profoundly existential. Now, Robbie and I go at it tooth and nail because he's tied to Aquinas, the greatest Italian philosopher in the history of the world. And I'm very much tied to Soren Kierkegaard, who was Danish and
idiosyncratic. I'm a little bit more, I'm more with Robert. Aquinas and Augustine.
That's what I like to hear.
But when Aquinas says, all of my theology I draw after my deep mystical experience, comes St. Francis, here comes Kierkegaard, elements of Augustine, here's Plotinus. I mean, so it's a rich tradition. Yeah. And we wrestle within that tradition, but most importantly, we understand that truth is something to be lived. It's not something to just simply contemplate in an abstract form that does not lead toward the fundamental transformation in your life, toward your neighbor, with a self-surrender to an almighty God that tells you that every human being is made with a sanctity and a dignity, no matter who they are, no matter where they are, and therefore there's a tie to suffering and social misery. And that's where, of course, you know, the legacy of the Black Freedom Movement comes in for me, with Martin King and others, right? You're starting on the chocolate side, you embrace all of humanity, but you're dealing with catastrophe, calamity, slavery, lynching, whatever it is, genocide in the New World, genocide in Gaza and other places, Germany and so forth, all this overwhelming suffering. What we're going to do? How do we respond? How do we keep loving? Lead with love and courage and know that it's cruciform, that the cross is not something you talk about, but it's something you bear, and you may end up being crucified on it yourself with a smile in the name of a Jesus who's already transformed your life, you see.
The book is Truth Matters, a dialogue on fruitful disagreement in an age of division. We are having fun with Robert George, Cornell West. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to get into a little bit of sort of the politics of truth. And see how our two spirited individuals, sort of out of the Aquinas tradition and the Kierkegaard tradition, wrestle with that little question. More of the Michael Steele podcast coming right at you right after this.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele podcast. So y'all didn't think we were going to get all up in your brain the way we have with Robert George and Cornell West. But we're there. We are working our way through it and really kind of pulling you to into a conversation about truth, what it is, what it isn't. And I think, gentlemen, when we look at our politics right now, that is the casualty of this particular political battle that we find ourselves in, is truth, where we can look at the events. You, all four of us, can look at the events of January 6th, and one of us goes, oh, well, that was the most peaceful thing I've seen in a long time. And then the other three will look at it and go, what the hell are you talking about? And the reclassification of truth to fit my political agenda, my political outcome, because it's not, in my estimation, a political reality, because reality is what it is. We all saw the same thing. I saw you take a flagpole and shove it into the chest of a police officer. That's reality. That's also truth, right? Is the truth what I then say it is in that moment? Because that's where this breaks down for a lot of people when, as we heard out of the first Trump administration, this idea of, you know, alternative facts. Are facts and truth the same thing or not?
Yeah, truth is reality, right? And reality is. Now the question is,
I saw you take the flagpole and shove it into that officer's chest. That's reality.
Right. But either that happened or it didn't happen, you know. And if it happened, we can't make it not happen by imagining it didn't happen. Or, you know, go to the other side. You know, Hunter Biden's laptop, it's disinformation. Right. Well, it either is disinformation, Russian disinformation, or it's real. And if it's real, you can't make it not real simply by proposing that it's Russian disinformation or Joe Biden is sharp as a tack. Right. Either is or he isn't.
Right.
And if you say he is when he isn't, you're lying. You know, you're not in touch with the truth, or you've deceived yourself. Maybe not lying, but you've deceived yourself. And we frail, fallen, fallible human beings, Michael, we are really good at deceiving ourselves. And that's where the tribalism comes in again. What's behind this post-truth idea or this alternative fact, whatever you want to call it? It's the tribalism. We care more about advancing our tribe, our ideological tribe's interests or values or beliefs or politics than we do about being in touch with reality. That is actually speaking the truth of the matter. And, you know, as for me, I don't care. Throw me out of the tribe. I might be wrong about things, but I'm going to tell you the truth about what I think about. And Cornell's exactly the same way. We have no guarantee that Cornell or I am right. Nobody does. We're all fallible. We could be wrong about lots of things, big things as well as small things. But Cornell's got to tell you what he really thinks is true, and I'm going to tell you what I really think is true.
But you can't be wrong, but you... So this is what I, you know, in trying to understand and unwrap, Cornell, this question of truth and what it means in the political context, because that's what's governing a lot of what's happening in our country right now. Our politics used to be informed by our faith tradition, our cultural traditions, our governmental traditions, the reliance on the value added of institutions like, oh, I don't know, the FBI or the Department of Education, which now both are being dismantled because someone has come up with a different truth about what those institutions are. How do we reconcile ourselves in this space when I see something that's happened or is happening, and I have tribes now telling me that my eyes are lying to me, that what I'm witnessing is not truth, that in fact, you know, Hunter Biden's, you know, laptop did not contain what we found it to contain, or, you know, the events of January 6th weren't as we saw them or witnessed them unfold, and that members of our United States government standing in the well of the Senate and the House condemning that event literally 2 weeks later, telling us that those events did not occur the way that they condemned them 2 weeks before.
Exactly.
So is the goal then to make truth such a lie that you just won't believe it when you see it?
Well, brother, this is a wonderful conversation. I just want to take time to say that this is rich, man. But Robbie knows that the great Eric Voegelin has a line in Volume 3 of Order and History. He says, Callicles, he says, Gorgias is the death sentence over Athens. And he was talking about the triumph of distrust, the triumph of cynicism, the triumph of rendering any attempt to get at the truth either a joke or naive or having no role to play in power politics. It's like Thrasymachus in the Republic. If might makes right, if power dictates everything that's moral, then it's not a matter of just an isolated incident like the Capitol. It's that whoever says that the Capitol was an insurrection, we've already shown that we should never trust them. So no matter what you think you saw, there's so many other things we've shown. Don't trust these people. They're not trustworthy. They're not in any way able to put forward anything that we accept. So we can end up telling you the earth is flat because it looks that way. And the people who say it's round have been lying on other things. Now it's true. You see, that's true that CNN, MSNBC, Democrats, Republicans, Fox News, Breitbart, all of them have engaged in certain kinds of lies, not to the same degree, but certain kinds of lies. And so when you plant a seed that says everybody is not to be trusted, then you could come along and say the earth is a unicorn after a while. Because any grounds for truth seeking have been pulled out. And so what Brother Robbie and I are trying to do in this book is to say, hey, we old fashioned, we old school. Just like love and truth seeking, just like integrity, honesty, and decency, in the end, it never goes out of fashion. I don't care if it's just a little small cloud of witnesses, it's still going, because that was true when Gorgias, with Plato's critique, that was true when they crucified Jesus, that was true when they shut Martin down. We know there's moments in which people owing to greed and envy and a whole wanting proximity to power and so forth, they're going to be tied to mendacity and hypocrisy. It's a human thing. And we're just trying to create some moments of interruption. That's all.
So Robert, that interruption then for me would raise the question about skepticism. Does skepticism reinforce truth, or does truth weaken skepticism?
Well, it depends on what you mean by skepticism. So let's distinguish the possible meanings of skepticism. And
I knew you would. That's why I asked the question.
Yeah,
I read the book.
You read the book.
Once, I'll tell a little story. I once sat on a plane.
Wait a minute. What was that, Cornell?
I said you read the text very closely. I appreciate that, my brother. Nobody had no brother.
I was once seated on a plane next to a monk, a Christian or I assume Catholic monk, and he had his robes on and his little rope belt and so forth. And we got to chatting, and I could see what he did for a living.
Right.
So he asked me, "Well, what do you do?" And I said, "Well, I'm a professor." And he said, "Well, what do you teach?" And I said, "Well, philosophy of law and moral and political philosophy." And he says, "Oh, philosophy." Said, I could never get hold of it in seminary. He said, we had mandatory, I think he said 6 hours or 12 hours of philosophy. And, you know, I was a good student on everything else, but I was a poor student in philosophy. But he said, you know, professor, I at least learned this much. I know what you do. I know what it is a philosopher does. I learned that. The business of a philosopher, he said, is to distinguish. The business of a philosopher is to distinguish. So I think we have to distinguish the meanings of skepticism. If by skepticism you mean the dogmatic denial of truth, then skepticism is the enemy of truth. If you begin by assuming there can be no such thing as truth, you're just going to explain truth away, and you're going to equate it with subjective feeling or desire. Right. Projection of emotion or something like that, and it becomes the enemy of truth. Now, a healthy skepticism is a skepticism that simply doesn't take anything for granted, that always asks the question, is it true? Or ask the question, why? If it's a moral issue, so why do we do that? Or why should this be our opinion? Mm-hmm. That kind of skepticism is always in order. That's not the dogmatic denial of truth. That is the kind of skepticism that leads to truth. That kind of skepticism is the skepticism we have in mind when we say that someone shouldn't be gullible or taken in. And in this context, I think have to emphasize, Michael, it's that kind of skepticism that enables us to recognize our own fallibility, to get out of the silos, to turn a gimlet eye toward our own ideological camp. So we're never tribalists. We're never ideologues. We don't fall into dogmatism. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
That's very important. In the text, you know, we draw a distinction between retail skepticism and wholesale skepticism. C.S. Lewis used to say the opposite of believing nothing is believing everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's right about that. There's no way that you can have a wholesale skepticism. Any mature skepticism is skeptical of skepticism.
That's correct.
That is actually correct, yes.
But
yes.
Skepticism has a crucial role to play. Stanley Cavell and others have taught us this. Namely, that it pushes us in a critical way, and it renders us intellectually humble. We're back to our finitude and our fallenness. We're back to our temporality and our traditions, but that doesn't mean history and tradition all we have.
Right.
It's just that we're trying to get beyond our context and recognize truth, reality, beauty is always bigger than just our particular context. And that's really a good, that's where phronesis comes in, you see. That's where Kierkegaardians even agree with the Thomists, you see. Practical wisdom means, like a jazz man, you got to time it right and know when to be skeptical and when to pull back on your skepticism such that you're able to make some kind of claims that are warranted. And that's not a formula. That's not an algorithm. You know, practical wisdom is a particular skill that you have to cultivate over time. You know, you don't follow some kind of abstract formulation. You got to do it. It's like learning how to ski. You know, you're not going to read a book and learn how to ski. You got to get out there and fall on your face. Well, that's what learning how to live is all about.
Yeah, well, we know that's right. Robert, what do you think?
Well, I was going to say to Cornell, I haven't thought about this for years and years and years, but your comment there just made me recall a wonderful statement by the great Jesuit philosopher Bernard Lonergan. Do you remember Lonergan?
Oh, the great Lonergan, absolutely. He wrote a
book on epistemology in 1955 called Insight, A Study of Human Understanding. Insight. Well, Lonergan said this. He said, yes, objective truth exists. There is such a thing as objectivity. But he went on to say, objectivity is the fruit of authentic subjectivity. That is to say, when we as inquiring subjects experience attentively, understand intelligently, judge reasonably, we reach valid, at least presumptively valid, conclusions. Mm-hmm. Those objective, that objectivity we have achieved comes as a result of our authentic subjectivity. So we learn the truth, we get at objective truth, right, not simply by having a look, but by thinking, by experience, understanding, and judgment, this dynamic process of inquiry. I think that's what it's all about.
But see, all of that brings us back to the thing that we clearly have stopped doing as a society. And it goes to what I was saying before about how our politics use was at one time informed by all these other attributes of our society that made this thing work. Because the politics was the execution of all those values and all those ideas and all those principles. It leveled up the policy. It gave us an informed understanding of why we want this social construct versus a different social construct. Now, our politics are driving all those other things. Our politics is defining our culture, the way we engage socially, the way we behave, in the context of, you know, communities trying to advance to the next level, that's now being pulled back and pulled down. So this idea of truth has been warped by our politics, as opposed to that truth informing how our politics will allow us to engage on all these other levels. And so the beauty of this book is it is a lot like that Moonstruck scene, and people who listen to this podcast know that I find that to be a definitive point when Cher slaps the crap of Nicolas Cage and tells him to smack out of it, you know, snap out of it, right? With respect to the question of truth, truth matters. Is about smacking you out of this haze that has sort of enveloped the way we see truth, which is why I asked the question about skepticism, because it, as you rightly put it, Robert, how you approach it will determine just how strong truth is going to be. And we either find ways to weaken truth to fulfill our own personal selfish objectives, or we find a way to enhance truth with true skepticism, because that's informing the truth that we're seeking. It's not weakening it. And I fear that we are now in a space where we give a damn more about our own selfish truth than the objective truth that benefits all of us. Does that make sense?
No, it makes a lot of sense. I just think there is a danger, though, brother. You tell me if you agree or disagree, of thinking that somehow when we look back, things were so much better.
Yeah.
Now, we do know it's much worse now, because the spiritual decay is deeper and the distrust is deeper. The paranoia is deeper. But see, truth telling has always had a little small group of people. Was America truthful about the Mexican War of 1846?
Okay, he gonna go there. Here we go, y'all. Strap in.
Ulysses S. Grant said it was the most unjust war lied about 1898 when Theodore Roosevelt started to, he lied about that one. He lied at the golf talk in Johnson and Vietnam. Lying is a human thing. It goes all the way back to Cyrus and we ain't got the Genghis Khan yet. It's a human thing. And same is true with Tooth Talk. Tooth Talk in 1950s. Are they in contact with the humanity of black people? What is the context we're talking about? We just have to say, as human beings, we're committed to a humility, a tenacity, a truth seeking, a justice bearing, and do the best that we can, regardless of whatever the context is.
You know, Michael, I agree with Cornell that we have to be careful not to glamorize the past, because people in the past were made out of the same stuff we're made out of, right? Flesh and blood. They were all fallible, falling, just like a bot. I had a little experience which I want to tell you about. Some months ago, I guess during the campaign, C-SPAN aired an old film of a debate in the West Virginia Democratic primary in 1960, a debate between John F. Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey, two United States senators at the time seeking the Democratic nomination for president. It was apparently a radio debate, but there was film footage that was taken of it. And the two candidates are sitting around a table and they're being questioned by West Virginia, my home state of West Virginia, by the way, that's where I come from. The leading journalists in the state, a guy for the Charleston Gazette newspaper and a guy from one of the radio stations and so forth. And the two men were having a very intelligent debate. Kind of Lincoln Douglas type debate, where they were not just point scoring, they weren't just talking, they were not just trying to impress people. They're having a very intelligent debate about tax policy, about the Cold War and the threat from the Soviet Union and foreign policy issues. It was absolutely remarkable, and I looked at that and I said, my goodness, there in fact was a time. There were actual intelligent debates, real discussions between candidates, and not the kind of thing we see on TV today. And yet, Michael, this was in the very primary, the West Virginia primary, which John F. Kennedy ended up winning, as you'll recall, establishing that a Catholic could win in a very powerful state. But the very primary in which Joseph Kennedy, John Kennedy's father, dumped an enormous amount of money to wage a scurrilous defamation campaign against Hubert Humphrey, falsely claiming that he had sought some sort of exemption from service in World War II, want to fight for his country. He was a coward. So you had the best and the worst there. In this same campaign, you have this intelligent debate, but it was resolved by a scurrilous campaign that blackened the reputation of one of the candidates deeply unjustly. So there we are, we human beings. That's
now, the bottom line is the more things change, right?
But we're hanging in there. We're standing up there. We're trying to tell everybody truth is more important than tribe.
Keep fighting. Keep swinging. Don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. You know that.
That is so true.
Organizing and bearing witness.
So true. Robert George, Cornell West, I swear, you two sides of the same coin, right? And that coin is truth. And I really appreciate both of you coming on and talking to us about how important truth is and how much it does matter. The new book, Truth Matters, a Dialogue on Fruitful Disagreement in an Age of Division, is out now. Folks, it is an intellectual challenge for you. I'm not going to lie. You're just not going to pick this book up and think you're going to read it like, you know, a love story or some of the other lighter fare out there. This book is deliberately written to challenge your understanding of truth and to bring you to a place of hopefully a clearer understanding of what that truth is and why it matters. And you both gentlemen have done a great service to me by sharing some of that conversation from the book with us today. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, our dear brothers. You stay strong. God bless your loved ones, though, man.
Thank you, man. They still put up with me, so you know that's a good sign. They still. I come home and the lights are still on. So. I'm excited for the little things, baby.
I hear you.
Robert George, Cornell West, thank you both. Thank you all also for spending time with us on the Michael Steele podcast. Don't forget to do that download thing. You know, I love it when you do. It makes me feel all yummy inside. Check out the new book, Truth Matters, A Dialogue on Fruitful Disagreement in an Age of Division. It's out now, folks. Certainly follow Cornell West on Twitter at Cornell West, Robert George at McCormick Prof on Twitter, X or whatever the hell Elon calls it. Until next time, guys, be safe, be well, enjoy us all on the Bulwark platform. We love it when you do. Take care.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.